Okay, this week's Parsha, finally, you guys get to catch up to us. This week's Parsha is Matos Masei for you guys in Chutz Laretz. We are only doing Masei, but that's fine. It is, I don't know if you've ever kind of poked around this part of the Chumash, it is the longest Parsha in the Torah. And it is massive, 244 psukim. And it's a lot of housekeeping because we're basically at the end, right? Devarim is entirely Moshe's speech. So it's a lot of housekeeping. So let's just run through it quickly and then we'll talk about five or six points on it. First part of Parshas Matos talks about the laws of oaths, vows, promises, etc. We'll have to obviously mention a few words about the power of speech. But that's basically the first parak. Then the Jews are commanded to take vengeance against Midian for the sin of the Benos Moav and the Baal Peor and the Benos Midian, etc. Take vengeance, we'll definitely have to talk about that. That is factors very heavily in this week's Parsha. There's a fight. No Jewish soldiers die. Right? Moshe takes 1,000 people from each Shevet. Nobody dies. Chazal explained that these were tremendous tzaddikim. They were not taken for their battle prowess. Pinchas HaKohen went out with the tzitz. He pointed the tzitz at the kings of Moab, the princes of Moab, and Bilam, and the Midrashim, how they were flying with the kochos of Tuma, and Pinchas uses the kochos of the tzitz and the Tara to defeat them. Okay, whatever. We're not going to talk about that so much. But there's a battle. Nobody dies. Moshe, when they come back, Moshe gets upset because they let some of the women who had seduced the men into idolatry and adultery. So they kept some of them alive. Moshe got upset. Moshe forgets the halachos about kashering and dipping Caleb in a mikvah, which we'll have to talk about as well. There's a long calculation of spoils from the war for all the accountants in the group. Then the Reuven and Gad, the two Shvatim, come and say, we don't want a portion in Eretz Yisrael. We want a portion on the other side of Eretz Yisrael. And Moshe gives them, and half of Shevet Menasheh, gives into the request to live across the Jordan River. He agrees on the condition that they come and fight the war of Eretz Yisrael first. The Navi talks about how they spent, I think, 14 years doing that, and then they went back. Okay, that's the end of Parshas Matos. The beginning of Parshas Masei is an entire list of the journeys of Bnei Yisrael in the desert. Like I said, a lot of housekeeping now. Long recap of their travels. Right, again, we basically started this journey at the beginning of Shmos. So we've been three Svarim. We're ending off this whole story. So a lot of list of all the travels. Bnei Yisrael are commanded to destroy all the inhabitants of Eretz Yisrael, destroy all the Avodah Zarah. If you don't, they're going to live amongst you and they're going to cause you problems. And sure enough, you look through Navi and that's exactly what happened. We have a list of the borders of Eretz Yisrael. Fascinating if you want to take a look at it. It does not align with modern day Israel. Very cool if you want to check that out. There are maps in, I would imagine, all the art scroll, Sfarim, etc. List of the Nisim who will help Yeshua divide the land based on the lottery. There's a list of the Levite cities. The cities are because Shevi Levi didn't get a portion in Eretz Yisrael. They get their own cities. There's a list of those or discussion of those. There's something called an Ir Miklat, which is set up. We'll talk about that. Basically, what that is that is a place for someone who kills Beshogeg. Beshogeg is often translated as accidental. It is not really accidental. It means with negligence. Someone, for example, is climbing up a ladder and is not careful, and they slip, they fall, they kill somebody underneath. That's one of the cases given in the Gemara. So again, that's if that happens, a person is not prosecuted and based in, they have to run to a near miklat and basically live there for the rest of their lives until the Kohen Gadol dies. Okay, so that's we'll talk about that a little bit as well. And then finally, the Sefer ends off with a problem, the Benos Tzlafchad. As you know, we mentioned last week's Parsha, Tzlafchad's daughters come and say, hey, our father died, he gets a portion of Eretz Yisrael, but he has no sons. So who gets his inheritance? And Beit Moshe said, if there are no sons, the inheritance goes to the daughters. So basically all of the other tribes, the tribes of Benos Tzlafchad, they were in, I think, Menasheh. So they came to Moshe and they said, hey, if the daughters of Tzlafchad marry people from other tribes, so they're going to inherit, their children will inherit our land, and basically our portion will be less. And so Moshe said, sure, okay, that's a good call. And Akash Baruch Hu told him, no problem, that's a good call. And basically they can marry anybody but within the tribe. And they did so. That's what Benos Tzlafchad did. And Chazak Chazak Finis Chazek. So that's a very long rundown of a very long Parsha. Let's dive right into it. Okay, first thing, as I mentioned, is the laws of oaths and shvuas. Can't pass by first part of Parsha Matos without talking about the power of speech. For example, Pasuk Gimel, and I forget which parak it is, but the third, basically the third Pasuk in the Parsha, has says Ish ki yidur neder l'Hashem, a man, someone takes a vow, etc., etc., etc. Lo yachel dvaro, he should not violate what he said. Kechol ha'yutzev mipiv yaseh, anything comes out of his mouth, he should do. And the Sefer HaChinuch learns that this is two separate mitzvahs. That one mitzvah to make sure you don't violate any part of an oath that a person takes, and that's the lo yachel dvaro. And the second part is the kechol ha'yutzev mipiv yaseh, anything that comes out of your mouth, you should do. That is a mitzvah to fulfill anything that a person swears to do. Now, this part is not as relevant nowadays. I don't think people really take oaths and shvuas much nowadays, but just to bring it down to a level which we can all understand. Speech in Jewish thought, as again, if you studied anything about the laws of Lashon Hara, anything Chavetz Chaim, speech in Jewish thought is not just something you rattle off without thinking. And we are, speech in Jewish thought is powerful, is legitimate, and has to be thought about, and has real consequences. Again, just to give a couple of examples, right? We all know that Shabbos starts at sundown, good? But if a person accepts Shabbos early, right, you daven Ma'ariv early, and you make Kiddush early, and you're sitting at your Shabbos table, and it's light outside, it's still sunny outside. If you strike a match, right, you're Mechal Shabbos. You're literally Mechal Shabbos. Why are you Mechal Shabbos? Why is that halacha different than if someone had not accepted Shabbos and done the same exact action, it would be nothing. What's the difference? One guy said Kiddush, Daven Ma'ariv, whatever, right? That is speech. Those are words, right? You have a completely different halachic and spiritual outcome based on words that you spoke. And the same on the back end, right? A person says, right, Shabbos ends. A person says, Baruch Hamavdu Mekosh Lechol. Striking a match is nothing. If a person is still in Shabbos, though, so striking a match is significant. Okay, discussion if it's after Shabbos, whatever. I don't want to, that's not the point. I mean, the point is that you can change the halachic, what we call a chalos, the halachic ramifications based on your speech. Right? The best example, something you've thought about a million times over, but you probably never realized, right? How does someone get married? Yes, the guy gives a girl a ring, there's Edim, okay, right? Fancy Gemaras and Kiddushin, etc. But what does the guy say? The guy has to say, he has to clarify, right, his intention. Right, he's not giving her a gift for her birthday. Right, he's trying to marry her. Right, when you combine the words that the guy says, and the Gemara explains that he adds on, right, Kedas Moshe of Yisrael, right, according to the laws of Moshe in Yisrael, and that gives based in the power to interfere if there's something wrong with the marriage, God forbid. That gives them the halachic ability to, let's say, annul the marriage in a crazy situation if they have to. But all these words, right, are legitimate. They're changing a halachic status, right? Again, the words that we say, the koach that we say, right, we have to realize that the power of our words, and again, nowadays with the phones, I've said a million times, right, the words that we text are just as powerful. Even better, the Gemara has a million cases of where a person says, marry me on the condition that, or this is your get, this is your bill of divorce, if X, Y, and Z. If, let's say, I don't come back for 30 days. Gemara, we're learning the Daf Yomi, points out that people will go out to war and they would give their wives a get. If I don't come back in 30 days or a year or whatever it is, right? Though that stipulation, Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel points out that stipulation is based on psukim we find later in the Parsha by Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven, right? It's all tied together, right? Right on brand, right? Speech is not something trivial that we fire off, right? These stipulations, the words that we add to our statements, has a tremendous power. It has a tremendous power to destroy, right? The Gemara points out in Erechin, the Milam Sakta, that the tongue is the only limb of a person that is inside as opposed to outside, right? And it's also guarded by two guards, right? You have the lips and you have the teeth, right? Obviously, again, Chavetz Chaim wrote at length about this stuff. Speech has tremendous power to destroy. On the other hand, again, because we're never always negative in this in this world, right? We always have to think about the positive as well, has tremendous power to build. Right? This shir, for example, is right now, we're creating tremendous holiness. What are we doing? We're just speaking. Right? We're just listening to speech. Yet, because I'll say all over the place, Torah creates a holiness in the world. We say every day at the end of davening, right? Talmidei Chachamim marvim shalom ba'olam. That's not hyperbole. Right, Talmidei Chachamim bring a shalom, bring a peace into this world through their learning Torah. Think about the power of tefillah. Right? What is tefillah? Tefillah is literally just words. Right? We've said it a million times, but it's important. You don't forget the power of tefillah. Just one illustration that you probably haven't learned yet. There's a crazy Gemara in Yoma. And the Gemara, the Yuma Daf Samach Tes. Basically, with the Chachamim davened to Hakadosh Baruch Hu, they saw that the Yitzhara for Avodah Zarah was so powerful, right? We talked about last week the Yitzhara, how in the world people could bow down to Baal Peor when it's this crazy thing. So we explained that there was, it used to be a tremendous taiva for Avodah Zarah, just like we have the taiva for Arayos and physical stuff nowadays. So basically, the Rabbanim fasted 3 days and three nights, and the Kosh Baruch Hu said, okay, no problem. I'll give you over the Yitzhara for Avodah Zarah. So this is just basically paraphrasing the Gemara. The Gemara says that the image of a fiery lion jumped out of the Kodesh Kadashim, and Zechariah, who was the Navi at the time, said, yeah, that's it, grab it. When they grabbed it, the fiery lion screamed, and this is what the Gemara says. The Gemara says that they said, oh no, what do we do? Maybe chas v'shalom, they'll have mercy on it from Shemayim. So Zechariah said, throw it into like some container of lead because lead swallows sound, etc. That's what they did. Very weird Gemara. And again, whenever I quote these Agadotas, I always point out that this is definitely not a historical book. We are not talking about history at all. Right? We're not trying to give you facts. We're trying to teach us a lesson. That's the point of Agadotah. But says Remelech Biederman, right, says if they were nervous that the Yetzer Hara of for Avodah Zarah could scream out to Hakadosh Baruch Hu, and Hashem would have mercy on it as a result of our tefillas. So Kavachomer, 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 our tefillas, when we're certainly Hakadosh Baruch Hu will answer. Again, definitely, this is already more time that I meant to spend on. But again, the shmuz about Lashon Hara usually come other times of the year, and tefillah Yom Noraim is coming up, so we'll get shmuz about that. But again, you can't learn Parshas Matos without mentioning the power of speech. Think about the speech. Even if we can't control every single word, we can still control some of the words that we say, some of the words that we type, and certainly we should think about the koach of our tefillos. Okay, now we have to tackle the, I don't want to say controversial, because I don't think it's controversial at all, but the more, let's say, I don't know, it's not PC, it's like brain-shattering, ear-scratching, kind of really weird-sounding type of part of the Parsha, and that is that B'nai Yisrael, when I say it like this, people kind of freak out. B'nai Yisrael, basically, in this week's Parsha, we're given a mitzvah of genocide. And that sounds really weird, and that freaks a lot of people out, certainly, post-Holocaust, and rightfully so. But if you look at the Pesukim, B'nai Yisrael were commanded to wipe out Midian. The Jews brought back women who had seduced the men, left them alive. Moshe got furious at them, and then they killed them. Again, this is, again, along the same lines, obviously a mitzvah to wipe out Amalek. That's a little bit different, but we have to talk about this. What is the deal, right? What is the deal with B'nai Yisrael being commanded a mitzvah of genocide? That seems something that we don't do. So first of all, just to illustrate, this was a very weird war. As I pointed out before, there were 1,000 people per Shevet, they're tremendous tzaddikim. The Medrash and Shir HaShirim says that they didn't even put their tefillin on in the wrong order. That's how amazing these people were. In addition, right, again, the Torah, again, phrases this not as in like, all right, everybody, let's kill some people. Pasuk says, Nikom Nikmas Hashem b'Midyan. Please take Hashem's revenge on Midyan. It's very clear that this is not a war that the Jews had to fight, but rather a response, right, to what the Midianite women did, right, again, to make the Jews, right, to commit adultery and idolatry. But still, right, still, what is the deal? So again, we've been explaining this for the last couple of weeks, pointing out some examples in the parshas, but I want to just give kind of like a bit of an overview and to give a little bit more background into this idea that we've been breaking out for the last couple of weeks. Things and actions, and again, if I've said this a million times, I apologize, but I think it's important to point out and explain. Things and actions in this world are not good or bad. They're not inherently good or bad. Everything depends on context. Everything. Actions, things that, items, right? Money is not good or bad. Depends on how you use it. And therefore, actions as well. Everything depends on the context. And how we judge that context, and this is a crucial step, is not based on societal norms or our own logic, whatever it is. It's based on the Torah. Whatever the Torah says is a mitzvah, whatever the Torah says is good, that is what is good. If whatever the Torah says is bad, that is what is bad. For example, last week's Parsha, right, we mentioned it a little bit. Pinchas murdered two people. Cold blood. He murdered them. Tremendous mitzvah. Saved the plague. Hakadosh Baruch Hu gave him a bris of shalom. He got to live forever. Tremendous mitzvah. Obviously, 99% of murder is terrible. In this situation, it was not. How do you determine which is good and which is bad? So we use the Torah as our guide. Another example. Bnei Israel used gold to build a statue to worship God. They do this twice. Once, it was the golden calf, and the worst, one of the worst sins of all time. And the second time, it was the Aron, and they put this with the Kruvim, and the whole, they put that in the holiest place in the world. Example number three, Nadav and Avihu, Aaron's sons, died. Many, difficult to understand why they died, right? A lot of possibilities, but in just looking at the Psukim, they brought Ketores, and Hashem burned them alive. Korach and his 250 men brought Ketores, Hashem burned them alive. Aaron HaKohen brought Ketores every single day and had no problem. Right? He took Ketores in Parshas Korach and he stopped the plague. The almost the singular difference between those three examples which I gave you, and obviously this is definitely oversimplifying, but almost the singular difference between all those examples is whether Hashem commanded it or not. In option A, where it was good, Hashem commanded. Option B, where it was not good, Hashem did not command it. And again, an avodah zarah is literally a strange worship. That's what it says, right? The pasuk says, "By Nadav and Avihu, Asher lo tziva Hashem," that they brought an avodah zarah. They did a strange worship that Hashem did not command. That's a pasuk by Nadav and Avihu. So here, the same thing. That when we say, "Oh, that's terrible! How could the Jews do that?" We're starting in the wrong place. The place we have to start is the Torah tells us what is good or bad. Yes. And as weird as this statement is, this is how we have to look at the world. Genocide is terrible unless Hashem commands it. Now, that is very difficult to swallow, very difficult to understand. And I will admit that after 20 years of thinking about this, I still do not understand it 100%. But we do not determine good or evil based on societal norms. If women from another nation come and seduce Jewish men and cause them to do idolatry and adultery, and 24,000 Jews die because of a plague, and the Shem Hashem is desecrated, there's a Chilul Hashem, Hashem commanded the Jews to wipe it out, to wipe them out. And that's our barometer. Now, again, it's much easier to understand when the enemy is like, I don't know, the orcs from Lord of the Rings, or like Thanos' army. Like, we're fine with that. Why are we fine with that? Why are we fine with that? That we watch that movie with, yeah, kill them, destroy them. We're totally fine with that. Why are we fine with that? Because, for whatever reason, for whatever psychological reason, we have registered that these factions are evil. We have registered in our mind that these factions are evil. Now, if you would turn it around and show the movie from their point of view, these people do not, just to use the examples, the orcs and Thanos' army do not think they are evil. They have a cause and they're trying to fight or whatever it is. But it's much easier for us to understand it, right? So we have no problem with it when we have internalized that things are evil. Well, what defines good and evil? The Torah defines good and evil. So the moment the Torah says, wipe out Amalek or kill all of Midian, so then it is as difficult as it is to say, we have to view them like the orcs in Lord of the Rings. Now, obviously, I'm saying things. I don't actually even truly believe it. I admit that I am very much struggling about this. But that's the message. That's how we have to understand it, that genocide is terrible unless Hashem commands us to do it. Again, we're going to talk about it in a minute. Shaul lost his kingdom for leaving one person alive for 24 hours. We'll talk about this in a few minutes. But that's the truth. If a Kosh Baruch Hu commands it, so then we have to, that's what defines good versus evil. Now, again, this sounds an awful lot. Again, the way I'm phrasing it sounds an awful lot like, I don't know, jihad or some other religious fanatical war. Something, it sounds, the Nazis didn't really believe in God, so it's not a good example. But like, what do you say when someone's like, oh yeah, what's the difference between Jews killing Amalekim and the Arabs killing Jews? And the answer is, as difficult as it is to understand, is that Hashem told us this is what we have to do. Therefore, that defines good, and that defines that's what we have to do. But they also claim to be told by God to do it, and the answer is, yeah, they do. So, but we're right. But they also think they're right. Okay, but they're not. But they say that they are. Okay, so that's in general the whole discussion between, you know, which religion is right, which religion is not. We all have Muslims, Christians, and Jews all say, lay claim to Eretz Yisrael. right? All of them think that they belong here. Again, that this is obviously not, we're not going to do this now, but this is the exact same discussion you can have whenever you're fighting about religion and what is right and who is true. Right? We use the Torah to determine good or evil. If the Torah says something is good, then it is good. If the Torah says something is evil, then it is evil. Right? We don't use any other barometer. This is even not as relevant for us nowadays. Obviously, we are not going out killing people. Right? The Rambam writes in Hilchos Malachim that Sanherib jumbled all the nations. We have no right to go kill anyone based on nationality. So relax. Right? I'm not saying that we have to go do this, but that's the way we have to view. This is the lens in which we have to view the world. Right? The Torah is our lens. The Torah is our glasses. Now, having said all that, if it makes you feel any better, I'll give you 2 points. First of all, Midian started. And that Midian, not only did they try to wage war on us by hiring Bilaam, but they also sent all of their citizens, right? They enlisted the women, right? They didn't send their armies. They sent the women and the girls, right, to go seduce. They knew what they were doing, right? So this clearly, Shmuel Golden points out that clearly Midian was guilty of including the entire population in the war. And once you include the entire population in the war, so now you're already, that's one army versus another army. Okay, so we defeated them. And something else that might make you feel a little better, even though that's not really my point over here, is that this is Sifri. The Pasuk says in Bamidbar that the army fought the battle Kasher Tziva Hashem as Moshe, right, like God commanded Moshe. The problem is the Torah doesn't say what Hashem commanded Moshe. It didn't tell him which tactics to use. Right? And it's especially weird because Moshe almost immediately afterwards gets angry at them and says, hey, you didn't listen to everything I said. So what do you mean Kasher Tziva Hashem as Moshe? What do you mean the army did everything that Hashem commanded Moshe? So the Sifri, which again is like a collection of rabbinical statements like a Medrash, so he said that the law of Jewish warfare, and this again is also brought down in the Rambam, is that in certain wars, they're not allowed to surround the city on four sides. They have to leave one side of the city open to flee if anybody wants to get out of there. So you have to give the enemy the option of fight or flight. So it says that was the point. I mean, that's how they encircled or they fought Midian. There was an avenue for Midian to escape, and once they didn't want to escape, so fine. So now you're in a battle, and then what happens in a battle, right? Obviously, the soldiers go and kill everybody. Okay, but we're going to try and sharpen this more because, again, it's something that I've thought about for a very long time. I'm still not 100% comfortable with it, but let's try and illustrate a little more. The Gemara in Pesachim says, and then we're going to talk about, first Moshe's anger. Moshe get angry. Again, we'll see there are four places in the Chumash where Moshe gets angry. This week's Parsha is one of them. Moshe gets angry when they come back, like I said, with some captives still alive. The Gemara in Pesachim, Daf Samchav, lists off what happens to a person when they get angry. One of them is that a person loses their chachma, right? And it proves it from our parsha, because what happened? Moshe got angry at the soldiers for leaving some of the women alive, and immediately afterwards, it was Elazar, a kohen, who took over for Aaron when he passed away. Elazar, the kohen gadol, had to give over the halachos of kashering dishes and etc. As Rav Chaim Shmulevitz writes in Sichos Mutzer, that anger causes a tremendous amount of things to go wrong, and one of the ways to avoid anger is to learn all of the statements of Chazal about how terrible it is. But, you know, unfortunately, even though we know how bad it is intellectually, right, it still doesn't necessarily help. Because anger, right, is an emotion, is a passion, right? It comes when a person thinks that he or she is right. Right? As Rav Chaim Shmulevitz uses a pasuk that Hashem said to Cain, famous, well, not so famous, but it should be a famous pasuk. He said, La Pesach Chatas Roveitz, that sin crouches at the door. So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, that's what anger is. Again, that was Hashem talking to Cain. He said, you know, what do you want from me, etc. That's already a discussion for Sefer Bereishis. But sin crouches at the door, meaning sin is always ready for us. It's always ready to pounce. So anger is also like that. Right? It's always a threat because everybody has an inherent ego. And people think that things should be like X when they're not. And people then get angry. Right? So anger is something that throws off our judgments. Right? Because a person who is angry, right, is always 100% convinced that they are correct. Right? You ever try and reason with an angry person? It's impossible. Right? Even though everyone looking knows what the deal is, but someone who gets angry is unable to see clearly. So the Medrash points out that Moshe got angry 3 times and forgot halacha, and the 4th time was when he hit the rock. Right, once in our parsha, and once in Vayikra when Aaron's son Nadav and Avihu passed away, and Aaron didn't eat the certain korban. Once when the people left over the man, and by hitting the rock. So now, if Moshe Rabbeinu, right, whose anger was clearly calculated. Right, again, Rav Shmulevitz and Sichus Moser points out that Moshe was right. All four times Moshe got angry, he was in the right. But it was still inappropriate. So Kavachomer, us, when our anger is almost never calculated, right, we have to think about and make sure that we hide ourselves from anger and peel back as much as we can and work on this midah, because everybody has a certain level of angry. And again, Rav Shmulevitz points out that forgetting your learning is not a punishment for getting angry. It's just a natural consequence. Right? A person who is angry can't think straight. Right? There's no chachma. He has no brains at that point. Right? It's irrelevant if he is correct or not. Right? I can think of many times in my life where I got angry and I was right after the fact. Right? Not like in the moment. In the moment, I was sure I was right. But even after the fact, thinking that I was right to get angry, still, it didn't make it, didn't help. Didn't make it right that I got angry. So just a word about anger, because it is so crucial to remove that from our personality. If Moshe Rabbeinu could get angry three times, right, and three times he was correct, yeah, forget the halachos, and get because of that, says how much more so all of us. So the Rambam writes in the first parak of Hilchos Deos that when working on yourself, right, a person should always strive for the middle road. Right? You should always try and be in the middle. It shouldn't be too, let's say, money-loving, but on the other hand, you shouldn't hate money and live like a pauper, right? You should look for the middle road, right? Just to give an example. In the second parak, though, right, he writes that there are some midos where that doesn't work. Right? And Halacha Gimel, he writes that that's true of anger. That a person should run far, far away from the other extreme. Right? And his language is a fascinating language. Right? He says, Hakas, that anger, is mida rahi ad lima'od. Right? It is a bad mida until to a lot. Right? He doesn't say it's a bad mida. He doesn't say it's a very bad mida. He says it's mida ra. Ad until le to me'od, to a lot. Meaning he's just adding things in there. That meaning it's very, 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 very bad. Right? Again, I don't want to, Rav Melech Biderman, we pointed out, explains that anger comes from a lack of emunah. You think things should be different, but they're not. Right? Hashem decided for whatever reason you should end up in traffic. You wanted to be there on time, but there's nothing you can do. So it comes from a place of gaiva. It comes from a lack of emunah. So if you work on your emunah, right, so you realize that everything is gamzul tovah, so mamela, right, and automatically you'll end up working on your anger, because you'll realize that, you know, things are from Akash Baruch Hu and you won't get as angry. But another piece of advice to how to work on your anger comes from the Igeres Haramban. If you've ever read the Igeres Haramban, such an awesome, little, powerful volume. He says at the beginning that anger causes a person to sin. How do you avoid it? So just like we talked about in Mesil Sisharam on Monday, that our actions causes our insides to change. Right? Very often there are actions that you can take. Right? A person has much more control over their actions than they do their insides. Right? Emotions, thoughts, that's difficult to control. But you can walk down the street. You can choose to, you know, do anything pretty much. So do actions which will cause you to anger less. And says the Ramban, which action is that specifically? That's speaking softly. If you can teach yourself somehow and work on the not raising your voice, that's the action that will keep your anger at bay. So that's the suggestion. That just a word on Moshe's anger, right? That speak softly, says the Ramban, and that way you will remove anger from your consciousness. But I do want to just go back to what we mentioned before about the war and the mitzvah of genocide and why Moshe's anger was justified and why Shaul lost his kingdom for not completing, right, the mitzvah of genocide. I think this is a very crucial point to explain. Again, what was the problem with, I mean, Moshe gets angry at the soldiers for leaving, right, a few women alive who had seduced the men, right? What was the problem? I get it. No, Hashem said to kill everybody, but a little bit of mercy, he left a couple people alive, I mean. Right, we're Jews are told to be merciful. Rachmanim b'nei rachmanim. What's the big deal? Right, and Shaul, even harder to understand. Right, Shaul was commanded to wipe out Amalek. Right, he left Agag, the king, alive. It was like Chazal say, it was like 24 hours, and for that he lost the kingship. I mean, like, dude, Hashem, like, give him a break. Like, he did literally 99.999999% of what he was commanded to, and Hashem took everything away from him. Like, what is the? I mean, what, you read that story and you're like, how seriously are these people judged? So on the one, you could say, yes, you're right, that great tzaddikim are judged, the Chut HaSaira, and Chazal do say that, or certainly about Moshe Rabbeinu and others. But my Rebbe, Rav Yonasan Sacks, explained a little differently. And now watch this. And this is unbelievable, unbelievably powerful. And I think a crucial explanation in this whole story. The moment you don't follow HaKadosh Baruch Hu's command to the letter, right? So you're not doing the action for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you're doing it for yourself. For example, or some aspect, some element of the action you're doing is not for Hashem, it's for you. Now, for example, this is not a big deal when you give tzedakah and the reason you give $100 to the seminary is because it makes you feel good, or now you can put your name on a list of donors or whatever. You know, okay, it's not the best level of tzedakah, it's 82% level of tzedakah, fine, okay, not a big deal. Right? Again, as we talked about, again, everything comes back to Mesilas Yesharim. Right? When we sometimes have to analyze our mitzvos to see if we're doing it 100% or maybe we're only doing it 70%. Fine, but when we're doing it like that for small mitzvos, not small mitzvos, God forbid, all mitzvos are big, but when you're faced with, let's say, you know, shaking lulav or giving tzedakah, okay, the worst thing, and I'm not saying this is terrible, but the worst thing you're doing is you're doing the mitzvah 80%. But here, what's at stake? Like, realize what's going on over here. In general, as we said, 99.999999% of murders are terrible. 99.99999% of genocide is terrible. If Hashem commands it, that we have to do one of these actions, because the people in question are Chayav Misa or whatever, okay. But the moment you deviate from that command one iota, you are no longer fulfilling Hashem's command. Now you're violating, in a very real sense, you're doing that for yourself, right? You're violating the Isser of murder and genocide. So why did Shaul lose his kingdom for keeping one guy alive? Because in a certain sense, when he kept one guy alive, so that those actions that he took during the war were tainted. And now he was no longer, in a real sense, not entirely, but in a real sense, he was no longer fulfilling the command of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He was doing murder and genocide, because it wasn't entirely how Hashem commanded it. Once you're acting on your own volition, so now you had the guilt of all of that murder, and that's why Moshe also got angry at the soldiers, because in a small sense, right, they were, I don't say murdering millions of people or thousands of people on their own volition, but once you deviate from that command, it's no longer the command of Hashem. So what gives you the right to kill all those people? Again, now for us, obviously, we're not going around murdering people, but it's a very important illustration of the proper mindset when we do mitzvahs. But when you go to shul because you like the social scene, so and you keep Shabbos because it makes you feel good or whatever, you need a day off from work, or whatever. In a certain sense, that's not Judaism. That's, I don't know, Tzviism, Belaism, Sarahism, Tamarism. That's our own religion, right? When people, you know, like when people say, "I don't hold to that." What do you mean you don't hold to that? It's not. What does that mean? That's not a thing. Like, what religion is that? That's not Judaism. That's, you're picking and choosing your own religion, and now it makes you feel good. So now, again, obviously, Judaism allows for self-expression. That's not a conversation we're going to have now. Certainly, we have mitzvos that we fulfill, and our own thought process during those mitzvos are unique. But you don't pick and choose halakos. That's not Yiddishkeit. Right? Now, again, I'm not saying it's all or nothing. Certainly, a person struggling with tzniut doesn't mean that she shouldn't keep Shabbos. That's not what I'm saying. But realizing that opting into some and not others, right, is not Yiddishkeit. And that's what we're trying to say, that we're trying to focus on Torah and what HaKadosh Baruch Hu asked from us and what the halakha say. Right? When we're missing some detail, so then our dedication is lacking in some certain sense. Sometimes it's not such a big deal. And sometimes, if we have the Avera, right, of Chas V'Shalom, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us to do something that's normally an Avera, so the second you deviate from what HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells you, so then you're doing the Avera. Again, that's not relevant for us, but again, we should really remember that we are trying to do what the Torah says. The Torah is the barometer of good and evil. That is, again, Mesilas Yesharim writes it as well. That's what we should be focusing on. That's what we should be focusing on, and not, you know, trying to figure out, right, how best to fulfill all of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's mitzvahs. Okay, let's get off that topic, because it is a bit heavy. And I do want to just do a couple more things here before we close up shop. I realize we're running a little bit late, but I do want to mention a couple more things. Again, feel free to drop off the Zoom if you have to go. Let's just talk about two more things. Oh my gosh. Swallowed an ice. That's so weird. Okay. Fine. B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven. A little bit odd. B'nai Yisrael about to conquer Eretz Yisrael, they're about to divvy out the land, and B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven say to Moshe Rabbeinu, all right, we want to live on the other side of the Jordan, on the other side of the Jordan. And Moshe is really not down. They have their reasons, whatever, because they have cattle, etc. I don't want to talk about the reasons. But if you look at the whole Parsha, right, if you notice, right, who ended up settling on the other side of the Yarden? B'nai Gad, B'nai Reuven, and Chatzi Shevet Menashe. Half of Shevet Menashe. What in the world is going on over here? If you look at the Psukim, follow the story in the Chumash, B'nai Menashe are not mentioned until the 33rd Pasuk in that entire story. What in the world is going on over here? Where did B'nai Menashe come in? Because if you look at the Psukim, very cute dog, if you look at the Psukim, B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven are talking the entire time. And all of a sudden, Moshe's like, all right, you guys go over there and also half of Menashe. What's going on over there? Second of all, why does the Pasuk call Menashe Shevet Menashe ben Yosef? What's the point of doing that? It doesn't do that for any of the other Shvatim. And finally, when the Pasuk describes the land that everybody got at the end of Parshas Maaseh, I should quote you Pasuk. It's Pasuk, Perek Lamed Daled, Pasuk Yud Daled. It says, Ki lakhu b'nei Reuveni l'veis avosam, u'matei b'nei Gadi l'veis avosam. They took, those Shvatim took their portion. And then it says again, v'chatzi Shevet Menashe lakhu nachalatam. And half of Shevet Menashe took their portion. Meaning it doesn't say all three of them took their portion. It says that Gad and Reuven took their portion. And then it says that b'nei Menashe also took their portion, even though they're all settling in the same place. So why does it say it twice? It seems to imply that the taking of Gad and Reuven and the intentions of Gad and Reuven were different than the intentions of Menashe. And sure enough, the Netziv explains that that's exactly what was going on over here. That Gad and Reuven came to Moshe and they're like, we want to be on the other side of the Yarden. We want to be outside Eretz Yisrael for all intents and purposes, even though they had the halachos of that back in the day of Eretz Yisrael. But we want to be on the other side of the Yarden. We want to be away from all of the other Shvatim. And Moshe was nervous. Moshe was nervous about B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven's spirituality. That they were going to be disconnected and they were going to be farther away and not part of the klal. And sure enough, we see at the end of Sefer Yoshua, if you've studied it, so these two tribes build the Mizbeach, right? At the end of the Sefer, and everybody gets all upset and they have to send messengers. What's going on over here? They clarify that, you know, it's just to remind our children, right, of the Mishkan. But listen, Moshe's concern was legit. And sure enough, these were the first tribes to be exiled hundreds of years later. So basically, what did Moshe do? Moshe sent them, B'nai Menashe, teachers and spiritual influencers, right, to make sure they'd stay firm. Right? He sent them role models. And that's why Menashe isn't even mentioned until the 33rd Pasuk. Right? Because they were never part of the thing. And Moshe was like, all right, if these guys are going to be on the other side, I got to send them, right, people to make sure they stay in line. And make sure they stay inspired, they stay connected. That's why it also mentions that Menashe took their portion differently than B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven. B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven wanted to live over there. Menashe had to be kind of like convinced and say, hey, listen, we need you to keep everybody firm. Why does it mention Menashe ben Yosef as well? But we have the same idea by Tzlafcha. Tzlafcha's daughters, right, are traced back to Yosef. And Rashi says over there, it's because they loved Eretz Yisrael as much as Yosef did. Right? Yosef told them to make sure to take his coffin. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu took Yosef's coffin when they went up to Mitzrayim to Eretz Yisrael. So Yosef very much loved Eretz Yisrael. Could have gone back to Yaakov, also loved Eretz Yisrael. Okay, that's a good question. But Yosef, who loved Eretz Yisrael, that's what Rashi says over there by Tzlafcha. It's the same idea over here, that Menashe really wanted to live in Eretz Yisrael. But they were convinced by Moshe Rabbeinu to go spend, take their portion with B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven. You see from this two things. First of all, how important Eretz Yisrael is. This is not an Aliyah speech, but the Torah mentions Eretz Yisrael about a billion times. Right? Not just give or take. Right? It's. I'm not saying it's something, you know, everybody obviously has their own cheshbonos, but you had two Shvatim here who did not want to be in Eretz Yisrael, and Moshe got really upset and was like, what's going to happen to your spirituality? It's not cool, it's not this, and that's not that. And sure enough, things went bad. Right? Eretz Yisrael is something to think about. Again, everybody has their own cheshbonos, but it definitely has to be part of the conversation. That's A. B, and more relevant for you guys right now, is we've talked about this many times, but again, we'll mention it here again, how crucial it is to have good neighbors, to have good chevra, to have good teachers, to have good role models, to be around to influence you. And we mentioned the Mesilas Yesharim, we mentioned the Parsha Shurim, I don't want to elaborate right now, but be mindful of the people you surround yourself with. Right? Are they bringing you up? Great. Are they bringing you down? Not as great. Maybe not necessarily time to cut bait. with those people, but be mindful of how much time you spend with them and how much they're really affecting your thinking. We see another, I guess, along the same lines, we see in the Parsha another idea about the Ir Miklat, which also underscores this idea to make sure that you're in a good environment. The Ir Miklat, as I mentioned before, is a place where people who murder Bishogig have to run. Right? They run away. They have to stay there. Murder Bishogig, just again to define, is someone who is negligent in his day-to-day. He was chopping wood and the axe flew out of his hand and he killed somebody, just to give an example in the Gemara. That is murder Bishogig, as opposed to obviously murder on purpose. So basically Moshe is commanded, and Moshe sets up six Ari Miklat, six of these refuge cities, three of them in Eretz Yisrael, and three on the other side of the Jordan for Reuven, Gad, and half of Menashe. Now, quick math. 9.5 Shvatim in Eretz Yisrael, how many Ir Miklats did they get? They got three. 2.5 tribes on the other side of Ir Miklat, the other side of the Jordan, and how many Ir Miklats did they get? They also got three. Now, the math does not work out, right? Why is it three on one side of Eretz Yisrael and three on the other side of Eretz Yisrael? What's going on over here, right? How many people could they possibly have had? B'nai Gad, B'nai Reuven, you look at the numbers in the census and the end of Parshas Pinchas, they did not have that many people. So what's with the ratios? So sure enough, Rashi on the Pasuk asks this question, and he quotes the Gemara Makos. He says, fascinating, that on the other side of the Jordan River, on the other side of the Yarden, Rashi's language is, and the Gemara's language is, Nefishe Rotzchim. There were more murderers. Now notice what Rashi does not say. Rashi does not say there were more accidental murderers. He says there were more murderers. And yet, that's why they needed Ir Miklats for people who murder through negligence, not through accident, through negligence. It seems like if there are more intentional murders, there are more accidental murders. And this is what Chazal point out, that when there's a society that does not value life as much as they should, so people inevitably are not careful when they're doing dangerous things. Like I said, like climbing ladders, knocking down a wall, chopping wood, etc. Those are all examples the Gemara gives. Right? If there are more people committing murder, Rahman al-Tzlan, people are taking life less seriously. So they won't be as careful. Right? We mentioned, it's super important to place yourself in a good environment where not only the people you're surrounding yourself with are people who are helping you grow, but also the town, the city, the county, the state, the place that you live in, right? Not only your immediate social circles, but even more extended, that has an impact on a person. Again, we sometimes kind of, I don't know, say laugh, but we sometimes feel weird about how insular, right, some of the really firm communities are. Right, how they shut themselves out from the rest of the world. And obviously there's positives and negatives. This is not the forum for that. But there's a reason they do that. Right? Again, think about what they're shutting out. Right? There's nothing, right? There's very little in Western culture that the average chassid wants to let into his home. Right? Again, back in the day, you know, they used to live in the shtetl. Right? There was, once in a while a caravan would come through town. Right? Everything was insulated. Nothing breached that little kind of cocoon or whatever of the shtetl. And then you had the askala, and then you had technology, and all of a sudden there are no fences whatsoever. So again, more relevant for us probably is, let's say, people who decide not to have a TV. So that's probably something we can relate to a little bit more. Why do people decide not to have a TV? It's not because they don't want to have fun or relax or whatever, or they think that your shows are stupid. No, it's because the values that you're bringing directly into the living room, right, impact the people living in the room. It's crucial to think about these things. Again, we've mentioned in Mrs. Yisharim, and I'll just try and finish on this. But you have to think about your environment. And if there are more murders going around in town, so then there are going to be more accidental murders. That's because the vibe is affected by the things that people are doing. Right? Think about your environment. Think about your friends. Think about the neighborhood you decide to live in. The kinds of things you want to bring into your home. The schools. What is happening in the schools you're sending your kids to. Again, I'm not telling you what the right answer is, obviously, but definitely think about those things. Don't just go through life without any thought process whatsoever. Okay, we'll call it here. One more little word. All right, one more really quick word. It says just because of the mention, the beginning of Parshas Maaseh has all of these travels from one place to the next. So one of the travels is, Vayisume Har Sinai, the Jews traveled to Har Sinai, and the first place they went to was a place called Vayachanu B'Kivros HaTa'ava, which literally means a place where buried, where the taivas were buried. So all the, again, well, okay, whatever. That's already that we had episodes of that in the beginning of Parshas Bamidbar. But the pasuk basically just to translate the pasuk because the Chassidish Rebbe's use this. The pasuk says Vayisume Har Sinai. They traveled away from Har Sinai. Vayachanu B'Kivros HaTa'ava, and they camped in the burial of the taivas. And all the Chassidish Rebbe's all say, when a person leaves Har Sinai, you get buried by your taivas. As we've been saying in the Mesilas Yesharim, the solution to a person's difficulty in spirituality, a person's taivas, they're feeling bogged down by the physical world, the solution is just learn a little bit. Just go back to Har Sinai. Right? Again, we pointed out on Monday where the Gemara says in Kiddushin, Barasi Yitzhahara, Barasi Torah Tavlan. And the Kosh Baruch Hu created Yitzhahara, and he created the Torah as an antidote. That learning Torah, whatever you learn, has an incredible power to push away taiva and yitzhahara, whatever. So if you're feeling bogged down, if you're feeling stuck a little bit, go learn a little bit. Whatever it is, pick up a chumash, listen to the shir, whatever it is. If it's related to the avera you're struggling with, even better. But I just wanted to mention that because it's, you know, a really, it's a cute vort, but it's also a very, very important vort. All right, everybody. It's great to see you. Thanks for coming on.